you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Dr. Travis Dixon, a professor of communications at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Professor Dixon is a media effects scholar who specializes in investigating the prevalence of stereotypes in mass media and the impact of stereotypical imagery on audience members. He's written dozens of academic papers systematically assessing the content of racialized media imagery and the impact of these biased depictions on viewers. Today, we'll be discussing his latest report entitled A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families, Representations of Families by Race in News and Opinion Media. It's a report he authored recently on behalf of Color of Change and Family Story. Color of Change, as you may know, is the nation's largest online racial justice organization. As a national force driven by more than 1 million members, Color of Change moves decision makers to implement changes in policy and practice that will ultimately create a more humane and less hostile world for Black people in America. Color of Change leads winning campaigns and initiatives across industries and government sectors related to criminal justice, the economy and work, politics, the environment, media, and technology. Family Story is a communications, research, and storytelling organization whose mission is to change the conversation about what constitutes good families by challenging unfounded norms about family life and structure and promoting the fundamental dignity, value, and soundness of a wider range of family arrangements and models than current norms often embrace. This new study we'll be discussing today examines the way that Black families in particular are framed in the media, both figuratively and literally, relative to white families when it comes to matters of poverty and welfare receipt, criminality, and father absence. And I'll speak to Dr. Dixon in just a bit after this weekly commentary. So a couple of years ago, I finished up my book, Under the Affluence, Shaming the Poor, Praising the Rich, and Sacrificing the Future of America. And, you know, this is a book about the way in which our culture venerates the wealthy and really bashes the poor. And part of my argument at the time when I wrote that book, right, was that we were increasingly, not just what the Kerner Commission talked about in 1968 in the aftermath of a number of urban rebellions in this country, two nations separate and unequal, but that we were actually, in some ways, even worse than that. It was a level of inequality and division that was more reminiscent of Dickensian England. And so I conjured up the imagery of A Tale of Two Cities, The Best of Times, The Worst of Times, coming out of the recession, in particular those at the top of the economic pyramid doing better than ever in many ways, in spite of the depths to which the economy had sunk during the recession, and then those at the bottom and in the working class really suffering as never before in spite of the so-called recovery. I also conjured Dickens in a different way. I talked about Christmas Carol, which at this time of year is probably a particularly relevant reference. You know, if you remember A Christmas Carol by Dickens, which he wrote, I believe, in the 1830s. I'd have to go back and look. I know I reference it in the book, and I just don't remember exactly the pub date on it. But Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol over the course of about 6 weeks of whichever year it was, 1837, I believe. And he self-published it, got it out really quick. He originally had wanted to write a book about the conditions of child labor in England at the time, and he wanted it to be a screed that would be non-fictional. He wasn't really intending to do a fictional work. And over time, he rethought it, and he wrote to some folks in Parliament, and he basically told them that he felt as though a fictional story encapsulating the drudgery and the evils of economic inequality would be more worthwhile. And so he focused on that instead, and he ended up writing A Christmas Carol, which I assume most of us have probably read, or we've seen one or another film version of it. And, you know, as you recall, the thing about A Christmas Carol, the story is basically the story of Ebenezer Scrooge, this harsh, awful human being, whose business partner, Jacob Marley, has recently died, leaving him with the business. And he is miserly, would be an understatement of biblical proportions. And at one point early on in the story, there are two men who come around looking for charitable donations for the poor. And Dickens essentially sends them away by saying that he has no interest in contributing to such charity because such people as are poor should either be sent to the workhouse or to the prison, or they should, in his words, simply go ahead and die and reduce the surplus population. His argument essentially that the poor are worthless and really serve no function. They are morally decrepit. That's why they're poor. They are deserving of nothing. That's why they're poor. And that people like himself, who are wealthy, have everything they have by dint of their own hard work, intelligence, genius, and effort. Now, at the time that Dickens wrote Ebenezer Scrooge as a character, make no mistake, Dickens was very clear that Scrooge was the asshole of the story. He was not the hero. He was the heel. He was the bad guy. And yet here we are, 170 years, 180 years, whatever it is later, and in the United States, it is as if the culture has embraced Scroogism, has resurrected Ebenezer Scrooge and his mentality in full force. And so you'll hear congresspersons, right, and senators who are talking about the poor as if the reason that they can't afford health care, you know, is because they spend all their money on the fancy new iPhone. Or the reason that they can't afford health care or they can't afford food for their family is because they're too busy, as Senator Grassley of Iowa said recently, they're too busy spending all their money on booze and women. This idea that the poor are poor because they have bad values, they make bad decisions. And this, of course, is why the Republicans in Congress can justify their tax cut legislation that showers benefits upon the wealthy, because the idea is, well, the wealthy are wealthy because they've made good decisions and they should be rewarded. And no, this bill doesn't do anything for poor people, but what did poor people ever do for us, right? What did poor people ever do for themselves? I mean, it's essentially this idea that the poor are poor because they are undeserving, and they should just go ahead and die. And when this tax bill passes and it repeals the healthcare mandate that has been in place since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, people are going to die. That's just a fact, because when this bill passes, it repeals the individual health insurance mandate, which means you don't have to have insurance anymore. And the people who are going to choose not to get insurance are disproportionately going to be younger people who are healthier. And when they remove themselves from the healthcare market, two things will happen. Number one, they may find themselves in great need, because you never know when you're going to need healthcare. I know young people don't think about it. I certainly didn't when I was in my 20s. But you just never know, do you, when you're going to need healthcare, when you're going to have a health emergency. So number one, it's not a real good move, but people are going to, you know, they're going to do that. They're going to decide not to get healthcare, and it could end up hurting them. Second thing it's going to do is it's going to destabilize insurance markets, because when the healthier, younger people remove themselves from the pool, that's going to leave the pool older and sicker. That is going to cause insurance companies to have to raise their rates. And when that happens, obviously there are going to be people who just aren't going to be able to afford care, even though they want care. They're not going to be, you know, voluntarily opting out, but they're just not going to be able to afford it. So they're going to end up delaying care, not being able to get preventive care, not being able to get care early on. And their conditions are in some cases going to progress and get worse, and some of them are going to die. I mean, that's just the bottom line. But they don't care, because we're back in Dickensian England, and we've resurrected Scrooge. And I know it may seem like I'm rambling right now, and I do have a point that I want to get to, and I'm going to get to it. Two things happened in the last 24 hours. Yesterday, I was sitting around, you know, in between Christmas shopping and planning for the holidays and, you know, just doing stuff that one does this time of year. I was talking to my wife about the tax bill and what it was going to mean probably for us. And I was saying, you know, probably not going to make a huge difference for us, probably be a wash, or if anything, probably will end up being a net benefit for us. We're certainly not the big winners in this thing. We're not, you know, we're not going to benefit from the doubling of the estate tax limitation. We're not going to inherit $11 million. So that part's not going to help us. We're not in the top bracket of income earners. So the reduction there is not really going to help us. But they're keeping the mortgage interest deduction, which will be something we can continue to take. The state and local deductions, which they've capped at $10,000, are really not going to hurt us because even though people in places like California, New York, and New Jersey, and Massachusetts, you know, blue states that I think were actually targeted by this legislation quite deliberately by the administration and by the right-wingers in Congress, they pay really high property taxes and they have really high state income taxes. Tennessee, where I live, you know, we don't have a state income tax. So basically what we end up doing every year is we deduct sales taxes. And those are just estimated based on what our income is. And when you combine that with our property taxes, it really doesn't come to more than $10,000 anyway. So the fact that they capped it at 10 grand is not going to affect us. So that's sort of a wash. Where we will probably benefit, though, is that apparently, unless they change this, it looks to me as I read the bill and I've looked it up and tried to make sense of it, it's very confusing. It appears as though sole proprietors, which is what I am as a writer and a speaker, right? I don't work for anyone. I don't have an actual employer. So that makes me a quote-unquote sole proprietor. That is what is considered in tax terms a pass-through business where the income that comes to the quote-unquote business just gets passed through to me, you know, as income. And then I deduct business expenses every year. Well, apparently, according to this legislation, so far as I can tell, it appears as though pass-through businesses are going to be able to basically deduct right off the top somewhere between 20 and 25% of our income completely tax-free. And then, you know, presumably I would still be able to deduct my business-related expenses, which involve travel expenses, airfare, rental cars, hotels, meals on the road, research materials and subscriptions that I have to have in order to do research for the work that I do. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, right? So if anything, this is going to end up being a wash or a benefit for me. And I hate this, right? Because this is going to be horribly detrimental for the country as a whole. Not just the healthcare thing I mentioned before, but it's going to blow a hole in the deficit, probably $1 to $1.5 trillion in additional debt over the next 10 years. And I'm not a deficit hawk. I realize there's good debt and bad debt, right? If you go into debt to increase your productivity by getting a college education or new job training or moving across the country for a better job or whatever, that's different, right? By definition, than going into debt for a new stereo system or a new car, right? Or a big screen TV. Like if you go into debt for certain things that have a payoff, then that's better. So I'm not a deficit hawk. I've never been one. But when you blow a $1.5 trillion hole in the deficit and you are someone like these right wingers in Congress are, who believes that we need to slash spending on social programs for working class and lower income people, that provides you the perfect cover for doing that, doesn't it? I mean, these folks just passed a tax bill that they know from every nonpartisan source is going to blow at least a $1 trillion, if not a $1.5 trillion hole in the deficit. So all of a sudden, they're not deficit hawks. They used to be. When Obama was president, they were deficit hawks and they were debt hawks, right? And the ACA, oh my God, that's adding on to all this debt. And they bashed him for that. But now they'll do this. They're not deficit hawks anymore. But once this deficit emerges and once the debt explodes, then they're going to come right back around and go, oh my God, look at all this debt, even though they're to blame for it. And they're going to use that as an excuse to cut programs they always wanted to cut. This has been their playbook for over 30 years, going back to the early 1980s. I mean, this is what David Stockman, the first budget director for Ronald Reagan, admitted they were up to. He actually acknowledged it. He said, look, the reason we are cutting taxes so much is we want to create a budget shortfall so that we cannot continue to pay for these programs. But it's a much better way to go about cutting them, isn't it? When you say, God, we just can't afford it. Rather than admitting that you view the people who benefit from these programs as useless, people who are the folks that Scrooge was talking about as belonging either in a workhouse, a prison, or simply going ahead and dying and reducing the surplus population. That's who they really are. So that was the first thing. Yesterday, I'm talking to my wife about this bill. That's thing number one. Thing number two is this. This morning, I wake up and I get my coffee and I open up my web browser and I'm, you know, looking around on the websites that I check out every morning. and I come across a story out of Texas. It is a story about a 7-year-old kid whose teacher, and this would have been, I guess, a first grade class, and the teacher had asked the kids to write a letter to Santa Claus to describe something that they wanted and something that they needed. And the purpose of the exercise was to help kids understand the difference between the things they want and the things they need, which is a great exercise, actually. It's a good idea because I think sometimes young people, and even those of us who aren't so young, right? Sometimes we get our wants and our needs confused. It's easy to do. We think that stuff that we want is something that we actually need. We live in a very materialistic culture. It encourages us to expand the universe of our wants and perceive them as stuff that we've really just got to have, right? So it's an easy thing to do. And this teacher, I think, was trying to get, you know, her students to really think critically about this. And so there's this first grade class, 7-year-old kid, Edinburgh, Texas, turns in her answer sheet to this question about what do you want and what do you need, and you're asking Santa for it. And the teacher is reviewing, you know, the answer sheets. And the 7-year-old says, quote, "I have been good this day. This Christmas, I would like a ball and a food. I need a blanket." This is a little girl. And she says, "I want a ball. And I want a food, but I need a blanket." And the teacher, of course, knows this girl. And so she goes to her and she asks her, basically, why did she say that food, for instance, was a want rather than a need? A ball, I get that. But food is something, you know, it's not a luxury. It's a necessity without which you die. So why would she say that that was a want rather than a need? And the student says, keeping in mind now, this is a 7-year-old, just to give you an idea of what some 7-year-olds are thinking about tonight. The 7-year-old says, "Well, you know, I get to eat at school. So sometimes, you know, if I don't have food at home, I know that I'm going to be able to eat at least at school. But I have a blanket and it's not thick enough to keep me warm. So that's, you know, more important, basically." And as for the ball that she asked for, the reason she asked for that from Santa rather than a doll was because, in her words, "at least with a ball, I could play together with my brother." She's 7. Now, as a result of this story, there has been a donation drive that has been started by the principal of the school in the hopes of bringing in 750, roughly, blankets for people who need them, which is obviously great. And the teacher who originally put this on her Facebook page has received all kinds of responses, and donations are starting to come in. So, you know, presumably that little girl and others in need in that school are going to get the blankets they need, maybe even the food, you know, if they're lucky, I guess. But in this season, where, you know, everyone is always telling us that we ought to count our blessings and we ought to be grateful for the things that we have, I want us to really reflect on how incredibly inadequate and pathetic it is to count our blessings, or how pathetic and inadequate it is to be grateful for all that we have. Seriously, what does it mean to be grateful for what you have in a nation where 7-year-olds write letters to Santa, where they basically tell Santa, "You know, if you can spare some food, that'd be awesome. But, you know, if you can't, I understand. But, you know, at least maybe a blanket." I mean, what is gratitude in a culture that produces that? In a culture that allows that? I mean, what does that say about those folks who march around and insist, as they always do, that we're the greatest country in the history of the world? How freaking awesome America is. My God, we're the greatest place ever struck off from the forehead of God Almighty. What does it say about those folks who are so proud, who wave that flag, who bray and prattle on about how awesome America is while 7-year-olds write letters like that to Santa? And we're going to sit around at Christmas, aren't we? And we're going to have our Christmas meals with our family, and we're going to pray these blessings over them like so many people do, right? We're going to thank God for the bounty that we're enjoying. We're going to thank God for providing for us. Think about how incredibly offensive that is in a country where seven-year-olds write letters to Santa asking for blankets and food as a luxury, while you sit back and you thank the Lord for all that Lord has done for you. You ever think about how offensive that is? How incredibly offensive it is? Because when you thank God for providing so much bounty for you, and you give God credit for that, what you have done in effect is curse God for not having done that for that seven-year-old kid. What did you do that the seven-year-old didn't? Because see, when you thank God for all that you have, you are suggesting that God is responsible for what people do and do not have, which means not only is God to credit for your bounty, but God must be to blame for that starving seven-year-old. And that, my friends, is bullshit. If that's what you think about God, see, this is why I'm irreligious, because if that's the God to whom you pray, if that's the God that you believe in, your God is evil. Because if there's a God that puts turkey on your plate and presents under your tree, if there's a God that somehow to credit for the tax cut you're about to get, and that God allows seven-year-olds in Texas or anywhere else on this planet to not have enough food or shelter or warmth, then that God is evil. That God deserves not to be worshipped at this time of year, but to die. And I can say that because I don't think there's such a God. And if there is a God at all, it's not that one. People who pray to that God, people who thank that God, wouldn't know God if they looked him right in the face, or her. It's an evil thing you do when you thank God for all you have while there are children writing letters like that to Santa. And what makes it worse is that while children are having to ask Santa for food and blankets for Christmas, we've got these lawmakers who are busy making sure that the nation's wealthiest people can afford a second yacht or a third or a fourth home. Not a blanket, a third or a fourth home or a second yacht. Not food, a third or a fourth home or a second yacht. We are a nation quickly approaching, if indeed we haven't already gone well past it, what Dr. King called spiritual death. And these people who've ushered us there, the same folks who love to tell everyone Jesus is the reason for the season, apparently forgetting what Jesus actually thought and said about the wealthy and powerful. He was not, to put it lightly, their biggest fan. Their Jesus is a counterfeit. Their faith is fraudulent. They are soulless vessels of avarice who blame families for their poverty. They'll blame a seven-year-old for their cultural depravity, their pathology. They view children as disposable when confronted with the more important presence of hedge fund managers and the inheritors of large estates. This tax bill they're pushing is going to allow those heirs to inherit up to $11 million per person without even being taxed on it, while families are skipping meals and lack basic needs, and seven-year-old children are writing letters to Santa for food and blankets. Not tax cuts, food and blankets. You know, as an irreligious person, I don't believe in hell except for the one that we make on this earth. But one thing I know for certain, as sure as I know my own name, is that if there is a hell beyond that one, there's going to be turndown service waiting for an awful lot of lawmakers, the President of the United States, and all of his enablers. You can bet on that. And I really don't mean to sound cynical about the prospects of things in this country or the lawmakers who govern us. I do fundamentally still hold on to the belief that Americans are better than America, and certainly better than its lawmakers. But I guess I'm just going to have to wait until the new year to see if there's any evidence to support my assumption. Happy holidays. Now for my conversation with Dr. Travis Dixon of the University of Illinois and our discussion on his recent report, A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families, Representations of Families by Race in News and Opinion Media. I spoke with Dr. Dixon last week via Skype.
So listen, Travis, talk a little bit about this study. What were you looking for as you're looking at media representations of Black folks and Black communities and Black families? What are you looking at and what are you looking for when it comes to both the source material and the subjects that you were examining here?
They asked me to examine the ways in which family is represented in news and opinion media. One of the things that we know is that there are racial differences in how individuals are portrayed in the media. And I've spent some time over the last couple of decades now looking at that topic and examining that topic. And one of the things we know is that there's something called framing, which is that African Americans tend to be framed in very negative, stereotypical ways in the media, and whites are framed in much more positive and powerful ways in the mass media. But no one had really examined, at least in news and opinion media, how families are represented. When we looked at it, we wanted to understand whether or not there were stereotypes affiliated with family that you see in these contexts, right? So that's kind of how we started off. Like, okay, there are families that might be African American or white. Are those families represented in an equal way or similar way, or are there dissimilar stereotypical ways or dissimilar frames that might exist for each of them? So we started with the national media that are kind of the opinion leaders, if you will, in this area. So the major broadcast networks. Then we added in the major cable networks. And then on the newspaper side and also online blog side, we started with New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, those national outlets, if you will. What we then thought about was the way that in which people receive news today. They also receive news from local sources. So you might have your local newspaper, your local newspaper's website. So we looked at those. We actually created a kind of randomized national sample of newspapers by region. And then we also looked at conservative media, if you will, including Breitbart, and also Christian media and a kind of opinion media, if you will.
So talk a little bit then about the findings. I know as I looked at the report, it seemed like there were three sort of broad areas that you looked at, as I recall. One had to do with the way that Black families are portrayed with regard to their economic well-being, issues of poverty, issues of receiving various forms of public assistance. A second had to do with the supposed, often claimed absence of Black fathers and sort of the brokenness, if you will, of Black families. And another had to do with the portrayal of crime, deviance, and criminal dysfunction in Black families and communities relative to white folks. So talk a little bit about those things. And then also, in addition to the general findings, which I found fascinating, was there any significant difference between the types of media that you just mentioned? So you mentioned national broadcast, national print, sort of an aggregate measure of local news media, and then also these sort of ideological blogs. Was there a variation across these different types of media? And if so, how big or how small was that variation?
I would say to you, the answer to the first question, let's go through the four major findings. So African Americans, when we look at just poverty, African American poor families were overrepresented as being part of the poor compared to their actual representation based upon census report data on poverty rates. Similarly, if we look at who's on welfare and welfare recipients, right, and we look at Black families versus white families, and white families, by the way, in all of these as well, if I think of poverty and welfare, I believe that they're both underrepresented as poor and on welfare. But African Americans in both of these instances are overrepresented, both as poor families and African American families are also overrepresented as being on welfare when we look at the welfare population. So that's the first two findings. And then the other interesting thing, I think, out of like all the findings, and that poverty finding is disturbing and problematic, but one of the more interesting things in the study is we looked at visual representations in terms of images that you might see of who's interacting with their kids and spending time with their kids and all of that. So we were able to calculate how often this occurred with white fathers, white mothers, Black fathers, and Black mothers. And what you find is, quite interestingly in this context, that there is no racial difference between white mothers and and Black mothers in terms of involvement with kids. What you find is that there's a big underrepresentation of Black fathers interacting with their kids in the mass media. And again, when we look at those proportions and look at the representation that we find in terms of how often this occurs in terms of involvement, when we look at CDC reports of Black father involvement, we find Black fathers are underrepresented as being involved with their kids in comparison to what happens in reality based upon what we know about Black father involvement. The last finding of criminality is Black family members are overrepresented as criminal suspects. What happens is you're talking about a family and maybe it struggles, and then you mention, you know, there's an uncle or a father or a mother who's gone to prison, and that's the way in which these crime roles are being discussed. Or in other instances, you're talking about something that seems like totally unrelated in a way, like you're having a discussion about an unarmed young African-American male is shot by the police in Chicago. So you're having that conversation about police violence against communities of color. And then all of a sudden, there's a pundit or someone else who interjects, well, the real problem is there's no Black fathers.
Right. Or they say the real problem is all these Black folks shooting other Black folks. I mean, when Laquan McDonald was shot there, that was the narrative. Well, yeah, the cop shot this guy and it looks a little suspect. But, you know, there were X hundred shootings in Chicago, or there were 30 shootings over the Easter weekend. So that's the real problem, right?
Or yes, that's exactly right. That's the more common thing, right? Yeah. That happens. But then what they do with the family part of that is they say it's really the responsibility of bad parenting, mm-hmm. particularly black father parenting. Mm-hmm. Like they just interject that as the reason for all of the problems that you just laid out, like what they call black on black violence, which is problematic term, right? So they say that, okay, that's the reason why we're having that problem is because lack of black fathers. Out of nowhere, without any context, without any facts, without backing it up. And most of the people who are saying these things are actually not experts either. So right. Those are kinds of the things we saw. You asked about outlets, and I wanted to answer that part. And the answer to that is that Breitbart comes out quite a bit. Fox News comes up to the top quite a bit on a number of these indicators or a number of these things that we examine in the report. You know, those are kind of usual suspects. Wall Street Journal comes up. But in a few other cases, we also saw CNN coming up quite a bit as well. And going with the other side, at the end of the report, one of the things we did, and we actually measured this as well, is we looked at stability, right, as well. The idea of social stability and social instability and whether or not families were contributing to one or the other. And one of the things that we found was that social instability tended to be more something that came up more with regards to African-American families or black families. But social stability was something that was often associated with white families. That social stability of white families is something that we saw with regards to being pushed by outlets such as ABC. Right. So I guess I should say that the media in general all kind of play a role in this, but definitely ideologically, you tend to find the conservative media pushes this narrative much harder than mainstream media.
Well, one of the things, and I appreciate you clarifying that, one of the things that I found interesting was the fact that on a number of these indicators, there were some real strong examples of CNN replicating some of that same stuff that Fox was replicating. And it made me start to think back to some conversations I've had with journalists over the years about why these portrayals happen. And you know, obviously with some and the more ideological folks, I think we can probably say, you know, the Breitbarts have an ideological interest, for example, in portraying, and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and those folks, an ideological interest in portraying black families and communities as dysfunctional and pathological. It feeds a larger narrative that's part of their politic. CNN, though it is certainly not as liberal, for instance, as conservatives would have us believe, it's clearly not an ideology-driven network in either direction. And so it makes me think back. I've had these conversations with journalists who will say they will sometimes defend those stories that you're finding, for instance, on their network as being their attempt, however clumsy, to generate sympathy, right? So in other words, if we portray the real conditions of significant economic deprivation that do exist in Black and brown spaces and that Black and brown families experience, they're thinking, and I'm not saying this is correct, I'm just trying to argue what they argue, right, is that we're trying to show that they're really hurting. And of course, I guess their thinking is that will generate sympathy. But you've been researching the effect of these media representations for a long time. What is the actual consequence of these distorted views? Does it generate empathy or something different?
It generates something different. It generates generally more stereotyping of the group. And it usually happens through a process that we call priming or increased cognitive accessibility of stereotyping. And essentially what happens is the more I see a stereotype represented in the media, the more it kind of activates a link between a particular racial group and a particular stereotypical trait, making that association stronger mentally. And so the more I've seen it in the media, the more likely I am to use it in real life. Or the other way that we've seen this kind of exist with regards to politics is the more you have these stereotypes accessible, the more you use them to make political judgments. So if the president, for instance, is going to begin saying that the main thing we need to do is curb welfare, when people hear that, they are not envisioning poor Appalachian white families right. that are going to suffer. What they are thinking about instead is that there are these kind of shiftless, dysfunctional Black families that are doing this to themselves, right? And therefore, they're the ones who are going to suffer. So great, go ahead and cut off that welfare so that those Black lazy families can, you know, just be heard. It's their own fault anyway. That's the image that comes to mind. All of the Black laziness stereotypes that have been invoked by prior news coverage.
Right. Well, and they may be sympathetic in their own way that they present it. But the difference between the speaker and the listener is a big thing, right? The speaker can be saying a narrative that is intended to generate sympathy or empathy, but the listener hears it based on a whole lot of other stuff that's in their head, right? So I can present you with a story, let's say, of the urban poor of color, some of whom are on public assistance, most of whom are not, or I can present you with the story about Chicago and the very real problem, let's say, of gun violence there and the way that folks on the ground who are Black have been trying to address that problem for a very long time. And I can do it in an incredibly sympathetic way. And yet the listener who watches that 5-minute story on ABC or on CNN or on Fox or reads about it in the Washington Post or the Chicago Tribune or whatever else is going to hear or see what they see based on a whole lot of baggage they bring to their moment of interpretation, right? It's why in the early 60s, when we had this focus on Appalachian poverty, and there was a lot of media attention in the early 60s and presidential attention in the Kennedy administration to the Appalachian poor, and it didn't generate this kind of backlash. There was all this sympathy. Oh my God, yes. Look at these people. Yes. They're during the Dust Bowl in the 30s. Oh my God, look at these people in Kansas. Talk about that historical piece, because I feel like people need to realize there's been a real shift. It used to be that we looked at these stories of need and poverty and suffering, and we had this sort of outpouring of support and empathy, and something changed. Talk about, based not only on this study, but I know you've researched this for a long time, what changed and when did it begin to change? What does that tell us?
So I would say that clearly the early representations were of white males, right, who had, you know, basically had some bad luck and, you know, were down and trying to provide for their families and facing difficulty. So you had the soup kitchens and the other representations from the Depression, clearly the Dust Bowl representations. That's how we thought of poverty. And then in the 60s, this is where it starts to change. A couple of things happen. One, Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders led a very successful fight for civil rights in our country. And we had the Civil Rights Act passed, and then we had the Voting Rights Act passed. And Dr. King had a lot of issues that he was concerned with. And one of them was the international one was Vietnam, quite honestly. But sure. The other one locally was about poverty. And so he began to discuss poverty and the intrinsic nature of poverty, both for African-Americans as well as for those in Appalachia and other places. And that's what he was spending his time on. In fact, supporting laborers when he was assassinated. And so this was kind of his focus. And the news media had been spending years following King and following civil rights leaders to inform the nation about the mistreatment of African Americans in our country and how entrenched racism was and how ugly it was, particularly in the South. And they continued to follow him as he turned to these other issues. And so that kind of race beat, quote unquote, that they were on before kind of became the poverty beat. And then Johnson was beginning his Great Society programs and trying to alleviate poverty and moving in that direction. So you had Johnson and King both talking about poverty. And that turn, which was, again, I believe, was done in a way that was trying to illuminate the issue and not done in a negative way, right? Right. It was not the goal wasn't to say, okay, let's make all the black people look bad here. It was an effort to say, look, we got to think about poverty in broader ways than we used to. But that's kind of how it began, and that's where it started. And there's a really outstanding professor named Marty Gillens who tracks all of this and how it gradually began to change. And then you had politicians at various points kind of accelerate this, right? And then began to invoke the notion of stereotypes, including Reagan and the whole welfare queen stereotype. And that's where that kind of just kind of began to be entrenched and accelerated to the point where Bill Clinton definitely decided that it was in his political interest to push welfare reform, because the image that people had when it came to the issue of welfare was of black laziness. One of the things that I should also say too, narrative matters and framing matters with regards to narrative, but sometimes just that depiction and that kind of picture, if you will, of poverty, which is part of what we were looking at too at different points, right? Yeah. Just the images themselves began to create that activate that particular trait with that particular group, and helps to solidify those associations, those stereotypical associations. Right. And so that's another place to really be careful, right? And that's what Marty's work kind of demonstrates there, is that just the pictures, just the visual depiction of poverty as an African-American phenomena causes people to think of it in these stereotypical ways that black families and black people are just kind of causing society's downturn.
And now here's my question, because this has always been a bit of a concern for me. And of course, as you know, I've used Marty Gillen's work in my work as well, and I've referred to it, and I find it really illuminating, as well as yours as well, on these issues. What I'm interested in is thinking through the dilemma that comes. So let's say, for instance, we try to shift some of this imagery, and we're going to get in a minute to the issue of what we can do and how we can pressure media to do better. But before we get there, I'm just sort of curious, we can do all that. And let's say, for instance, that the media began to represent these things more accurately. And let's say that, you know, they began to represent the issue of poverty and family breakdown, quote unquote, and crime in a more statistically representative way, which would therefore mean that the majority of poor people we would see in media would clearly be white. The majority of people in stories about crime would clearly be white. Here's my concern. That would be more accurate. My concern would be, you know, Eduardo Bonilla Silva and others who talk about colorblind racism have talked about the way that white folks will latch on to really anything to prove that we don't have a racism problem in America. And I always wonder, because I remember back in 90 and 91 when I was doing work against David Duke in Louisiana when he ran for Senate and governor, his argument always was, well, I'm not racist because I call for welfare reform because, you know, most of the people on welfare and most of the people who are poor are white. In other words, he would make that point as a way to get himself out of the argument that it was racist. And so I feel like we have to figure out, yeah, we want to make it more accurate, but we don't want to do so at the cost of allowing these reactionaries to say, oh, you're right. And therefore, it's not racist when we call for law and order, even though we know what their real motives are. Or it's not racist when we call for stop and frisk because, yeah, you're right. Most of the crime is committed by white people. I don't want to give them an out. You know what I mean? So how do we balance the need to be accurate with the need to remind people, yeah, there is disproportionate poverty and economic deprivation in black spaces?
First thing is, let's get accurate, right? So let's say the media gets accurate. Then the second part of this is you provide background, real experts, and begin to talk about what underlies some of these issues, right? So poverty is a very complex problem. There are societal parts and there are individual parts, and they all come together to create the outcomes. There are all these parts to why people are poor, even why African Americans are disproportionately poor. And you can look at like wealth distributions and all kinds of, you know, there are lots of complex reasons why this happens. Sure. But the part of the answer is start talking about those things. Start talking about all of the contextual variables that create complex things like who's on welfare, how is fatherhood depicted, and how is crime depicted. You have to give the entire picture. And by the way, I think there are different roles for different people. Like the media's job, quite honestly, what we really can ask them to do is just be accurate and try to provide context where they can. But then activists who are around these issues need to then call out the dog whistles and do other things, right? So everybody has different roles. You know, as a scholar, my main role is to produce accurate, socially, scientifically sound data that really explains what's happening in these contexts. The activists can hopefully take some of this information and then advocate for better policies around these issues and call out politicians and others who would try to distort these various issues. That's what I would say. Everybody has a different role.
Let's say, you know, for the typical white person out there who may not even be reactionary, may not be someone who necessarily buys into the stereotypes that the media is representing, but nonetheless doesn't see how this affects them. For that person who's white and hears that and goes, yeah, that's terrible, and they sort of get it at the academic level, how do we make them understand that they have a stake too in changing this? Because I feel like there are some pretty obvious ways that this misrepresentation actually is bad for everyone. It's not just bad for the communities that are directly impacted by bias. I would argue that there are real blowback effects on even white folks. What might some of those be? Why should white folks, for instance, who hear this stuff, you know, care other than, well, it's just horrible and we should fix it? What are some other reasons, even for self-interest?
I think the answer is that we can't get to good policy, which will help raise all of our boats, if you will, if we don't have good information and accurate information. So as an example of this, Obamacare has been just assaulted, and it's been assaulted for years by Republicans, largely because of its name. It's this black guy. And there are millions of people for years, I believe, who thought Obamacare is just some freaking welfare program for black people, right? Right. It's some giveaway to African Americans, and African Americans always want some handout.
Glenn Beck actually said, when he still was relevant and had a show, Glenn Beck said that Obamacare was just his way of getting reparations for black people. I mean, he literally said that.
Exactly. Yeah. That was put out there by the conservative media and people like Beck for years. And large swaths, particularly the Republican Party, believe that. So you vote for all these Republicans and say, yeah, I want Republicans to go in there and get rid of this Obamacare.
Right.
And then what happened? It looks like they may get rid of the individual mandate as we speak. We don't know. But the idea is that, right, like once people realize, wait a second, this is my health care. Did I just vote for you and you're really going to take away my health care? And again, partly because it wasn't explained and or those narratives and frames weren't counteracted effectively, if you will, by the Democrats for years, they kind of let that go. That was not good for them either, right? So you have to engage the frame, I guess is my answer. You have to engage the frame in a way that you talk about how all of these policies relate to all of our pocketbooks in ways that if you're not paying attention, you're going to actually end up hurting yourself. If you take away health care for the black people, you also lose the health care.
Well, and it seems to me that people's lives are literally on the line, too. It isn't even just their pocketbook. I mean, I think about the fact we have all these stories now about the opioid crisis and these white communities, right, that are struggling dealing with drug issues. Well, you know, perhaps if the media had not facilitated this political narrative that drugs were an urban problem, a black problem, a brown problem. And then, of course, that led to a focus on incarceration and punishment rather than education and rehab. Maybe we wouldn't be in this position. And so maybe some of these white folks who ignored that or who sort of went along with that narrative because it didn't affect them and now they're dying, literally dying. That wouldn't be happening. Or I think about this video we've all been seeing the last 5 or 6 days, I guess, is when it sort of went viral. This video of this white dude being shot in the hall of a hotel in Arizona, right?
Yes.
I mean, absolutely. This guy just gets straight murdered by a cop who gets acquitted, who just got acquitted. And of course, you know, this issue of cops overreacting and engaged in unaccountable violence against folks because we've seen it as, and of course it is disproportionately against black and brown folks, but the reality is there are lots of white folks getting shot unjustly by law enforcement every year, and yet because the media doesn't talk, you know, we've got this image that's been fed by politicians for their own reasons and by media as well that lowers the threshold for what we allow to be acceptable. But it seems like we don't even realize once you lower the threshold based on your media fed imagery of who is getting shot and you go, oh, it's just these quote unquote thugs in wherever it is, then you realize that it's going to be your own kids and your own nephews and your own whatever. They're going to get shot too because you've basically told the police you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
Well, when we think about solutions then, what do you think the focus ought to be? Is it putting pressure on those media outlets? Is it trying to make sure we have more people of color in those positions who can, from the inside, maybe change that narrative? Or is it both of those, but also a healthy dose of trying to create our own media narratives? Because I do feel like we are living in a moment where people have the ability, more so than ever before, in spite of all the problems that exist with social media and with, you know, the fact that there's a million voices and they all are, you know, bouncing off your head at the same time. That's obviously a problem. But people do have the ability now to say, like, okay, yeah, I want to change what the networks do, but I also want to, I'll create my own shit, you know, and I'll put out my own stuff and try to spread that. So what's the proper balance?
Think it's all of the above, but I would say startup, one of the really cool things about, you know, the world in which we live in now is all of the technological advancements. It's really easy for news media organizations to understand now when they've screwed up. Just think about the Nazi story that the New York Times did.
Yeah.
Recently, where people just, you know, in social media, also in other contexts, gave immediate feedback to New York Times saying, what were you thinking? Why did you do this?
Yeah, that couldn't have happened 20 years ago. That just wouldn't have happened.
Right?
And just real quick, for some of the listeners who might not know what Dr. Dixon's talking about, the New York Times got in some hot water recently because they had run an article that essentially normalized this Nazi who they featured. You know, they talked about him being a white nationalist, a white supremacist, just an overtly racist guy. But they also wanted to let you know, he eats at Applebee's or whatever. And, you know, he's just like you, you know, he's really normal, except for the whole Hitler loving thing. So I just want to make sure everybody knows what that story is about.
Look how fast the reaction was. Like, people react very quickly. I don't know if you saw this. Just, you know, again, I'm sure this was backlash from the media. But this morning, Chicago Tribune came out and said that, and I don't want to misquote all of this because I kind of glanced at this, but I guess the city was considering suing the family members of someone that actually had been killed by the police. So the city was going to sue to recoup. And then about an hour later, another one came up saying, city no longer pursuing that. Now, I wonder what happened in that hour.
Yeah, right. Now, yeah, they didn't just go, oh, that was a bad idea. Like, somebody got on their ass, clearly.
Right, somebody did. And it was a reaction, right? And people can give feedback. In that case, it was really to a political, probably to the mayor's office. His phone probably rung off the hook. You know, people can give that immediate feedback directly to the outlets, and they can say things like, I'm subscribing, I'm not going to subscribe anymore, right?
Yeah.
You can, and this is in the report about targeting advertisers, you can say, you know, you're advertising on this program, and there's this particular program where, I don't know, like, I feel like every other month they're pushing some sort, or regularly, you know, every day or whatever, they're pushing these narratives that I know to be inaccurate, and I find distasteful, and everybody's trying to be competitive and keep a large share, and if they're consistently getting the backlash and the feedback that they're not doing something they need to do, that's where you have power as a consumer, right? You can voice it, and you can turn the channel and make other choices, right? That's the other part of what you're saying, which is create your own content and link to others' content that you feel is more representative, doing a better job. And when they are doing a better job, share it, as well as give the feedback that, hey, you know, feedback should go two ways. That was really good. I'm really glad you said that. I'm really glad you gave context to that issue and giving voice to that issue. And then when someone isn't, you know, and they're actually promoting stereotypes, stereotypes say that too. I think that those are all ways to fight back as an individual consumer. We have recommendations for what the media should be thinking about, but as an individual, your power really lies with your feedback as well as your decision to mini boycott and or pressure advertisers. That's really where your power lies.
And I think about it a lot as a, you know, as a parent of teenagers and knowing that they're imbibing media constantly. And, and you know, you're teaching in an institution. I guess the last question I would have for you, you've got young people who come in to that institution who have been more than any generation before them bombarded with media imagery, some of it good, some of it bad, some of it really bad. How hard do you find it or how easy or how hard or just how do you find them when you present them with some of the information that you have culled over the years of your professional work? How bought in are they to these stereotypes and how hard do you find it to help them unwind some of that? Give us some hope, I guess, is what I'm sure. Asking you for.
Actually, you know what? I would say two things I've noticed. One, when I first started teaching media effects, and that was in the early 2000s when I first started my career, I would say that a lot of people didn't really believe, like more of my students would say, I'm not really influenced by the media or... I know how it's just entertainment and I can differentiate. And this is before, of course, we had social media sure. and all the other kind of technological changes. So it was all traditional media at that time. But basically, they were like, a lot of them were skeptical that it influenced them. And today, I can't find anybody to say that. Mm. I've been asking that same question for 20 years. And they're all aware that they are consciously or unconsciously influenced by the images that they come across in the mass media. And so that's one thing that I've seen that's definitely different over the last 20 years. The other thing that I've seen, I have different components of media effects that I teach in my classes. And in most of my classes, I at some point have to talk about politics and communication and media. And I have conversations with them about just like, what is their engagement? What are they aware of? How does our democracy work? Just really questions about understanding that those fundamentals of democracy and information. And I have to say, like when I used to do this, that was the, you know, every professor has this. That was the glaze my eyes over moments in class. Like, oh, we're going to talk about politics. Right. And okay, I don't really care about that. I can tell you that is not been the case in my classes since the last election. Students are really engaged. I'm getting, when I ask just even what our government structure is, I'm getting sophisticated answers back that I used to not hear. Or if I ask them about a policy, what is in the policy, they give me, you know, really complex answers back.
So maybe the good news then to take away even from this really disturbing report that you helped to craft here is that the levels of misinformation and misrepresentation, however dangerous they obviously can be and have been, that people are paying attention more than perhaps they have been. They're open to the idea that they're being played and being manipulated, which actually ought to, for those folks in the media who are sitting there wondering, well, do we really have the time to get it right, or should we even care about this? Like, there's a market for accurate information out there. There are people out there who are hungry for real information, so you don't have to sit back in those newsrooms and be lazy. You can go out and do the real work and find the real information, and people are ready for that, it sounds
like. Students ask me every semester, I have students who are asking me, where can I get really good, accurate information? And I try to give them a couple of suggestions for how to use their smartphone for getting just good, nonpartisan, just good information. You know,
sure.
This is all media literacy stuff. And so we talk extensively about that now in class as well.
Well, that is fantastic. I appreciate you so much for the work you do both on a daily basis as a professor, but also this work you've done with this incredible report. I'm going to make sure to let folks know how to get a copy of the report and just keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you. You too.
For those interested in reading the report, A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families, Representation of Families by Race in News and Opinion Media, which we discussed today, you can do so at colorofchange.org. That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.